First on BBC Radio 4, the story of a Harvard professor's struggle to get the scientific community to take his research into alien abduction seriously. Here's the BBC's science and environment correspondent Sue Nelson with Abduction, Alienation and Reason.
The city of Boston has a rich history, from being a Native American settlement to hosting a colonial tea party and the first public reading of the Declaration of Independence. It was also the location for some of the infamous witch trials held in the 17th century along the northeast coast of the United States. Across the river from Boston lies the town of Cambridge, which houses two of the world's most renowned universities, MIT and Harvard. And Harvard Square is where I am now, the intellectual hub of the city. It was the scene of one Harvard professor's fight for academic freedom, and what was described at the time, around a decade ago, as a modern-day witch hunt to remove this man from his post. The professor was a psychiatrist called John E. Mack. His chosen subject was alien abductees, or, as they like to be known, experiencers.
I had a thing on my bed that looked like an insect with like a big overgrown bug with a stick-like neck that looked biomechanical in nature and big liquid black wraparound eyes, and didn't look anything like I had ever seen. Like, I'm getting chills thinking about it. And then what happens is it feels like the body's molecules excite to this intense degree that we would become something like light or like, you know, heat. There's no movement. That's terrifying.
You really feel like you're being communicated to. You just hear it in your mind. And what I realized was that I've actually been having these experiences since childhood.
And then you end up in this place, God forbid that we actually call it a ship. I can't even say it with a straight face. The rooms are very curved, it's very quiet. Then there's a whole other experience that includes a medical exam, that includes interfacing with these beings, and sometimes includes interfacing with other human beings. The beings would show images of the Earth being destroyed. The whole thing is absurd. That doesn't mean it's not happening.
In the early 1990s, John Mack, an eminent Harvard psychiatrist and psychoanalyst, began investigating people who said that they were in contact with extraterrestrial life. Even though the X-Files had yet to be broadcast, meeting ET is a popular theme in entertainment, and a belief in UFOs was, as it remains now, something of a phenomenon. Around 4 million Americans, for instance, claim to have been abducted by aliens. But what upset the academic establishment of Harvard even more than John Mack's decision to tackle the subject in the first place was that this highly respected professor and Pulitzer Prize winner took what the abductees were reporting extremely seriously.
These people, as far as I could tell, were of sound mind, had not communicated with each other, were not getting details from the media. This was long before the great media rash of information on this subject. They were reluctant to come forth, and they described similar stories in great detail and were shocked when they would hear that someone else had had a similar experience. And the only thing as a psychiatrist that I knew that behaved like that was real experience.
To the embarrassment of Harvard, John Mack's research into alien abductees or experiences became highly public, and the professor became something of a celebrity. But Mack paid a personal price by giving such a controversial area academic scrutiny. He almost lost his job. This is the story of that struggle from those who were closest to John Mack. Unfortunately, he died in a car accident last autumn, but we can still hear his side of the battle with Harvard from archive recordings.
What are the other possibilities? Dreams, for instance. Dreams do not behave like that. Dreams are highly individual. One dreams according to what's going on in your unconscious at that particular time, and the dreams of one person are quite different from those of another. Or some kind of trauma, for instance, like sexual abuse, which is often raised. I would never say, yes, there are aliens taking people. I would say there is a compelling, powerful phenomenon here that I can't account for in any other way, that's mysterious. There isn't a single case of an alien abduction story that fulfills my criteria that has turned out to be anything else. And yet I can't know what it is. But it seems to me it invites some kind of deeper, further inquiry.
Most people would agree that the abduction scenario lies in the realm of science fiction. Those who claim to be an unwilling part of this often speak of being surrounded by strange-looking beings and, more disturbingly, sometimes forcing them into sexual encounters to produce hybrid human-alien offspring. I met two of Mac's abductee case studies, Karen Austin and Peter Faust, in the suburbs of Boston. Not surprisingly, when their experiences first began, they each thought they were going crazy.
Have I ever questioned my own sanity? Absolutely. I mean, every day, you know, to a certain degree, because the majority of the world says that you're crazy for having this experience. But if it was just me who had contact with aliens, who had intimate experiences or mating experiences with female aliens and then producing some type of offspring, I would say I'm certifiable. Put me away. I'm crazy. But then when I began to look at the experience outside myself and realize that hundreds, if not thousands of people, both men and women, report the exact same experience, it gave me a sense of sanity. I couldn't be making this up. I couldn't be fantasizing this.
I think the thing that was most convincing for me was the fact that there was always a physical component. I would wake up the next day after certain experiences with corroborating marks on my body, and one final experience happened fully physically, fully in my room, on my bed, with my fiancé sleeping next to me, and I was totally awake for it, like, I'm awake here speaking with you now. And at that point, I stopped fighting about whether or not it was real, and I just accepted it and thought, okay, I'm going to move forward in the rest of my life, recognizing that there's something out there that we don't understand.
John Mack began his career specializing in the psychology of sleep and dreams. He gained an international reputation as an expert in child and adult psychoanalysis and the misunderstood or vulnerable, especially children contemplating suicide. As well as these solid and impressive academic credentials, friends and colleagues considered him adventurous, always asking questions that others didn't ask. Professor of Psychology and Psychiatry Robert J. Lifton worked with Mac at Harvard and was a close personal friend for many years.
I would point to his earlier work prior to his work with UFOs as an expression of his adventurousness. His work on T.E. Lawrence, which was really the work of both a scholar and a romantic. He became fascinated with T.E. Lawrence from watching the famous film about him, Lawrence of Arabia, and took off to Europe to study him. It was an enormously adventurous and unconventional thing to do.
Mac's research into the psychiatric dimensions of Lawrence's personality resulted in the book A Prince of Our Disorder. It earned him the Pulitzer Prize for Biography in 1977. Perhaps it was no surprise then that John Mack should venture into the realm of alien abduction.
I wasn't entirely surprised because I knew John well enough to recognize that he would take some unconventional path and that this adventurousness would contribute to it.
Did you think it was a good idea, though, for his academic career?
Neither he nor I worried about his academic career in terms of that step. It was something he had to do. He was an accomplished clinician, was known as an excellent therapist and clinically very astute. And his first findings were in the spirit of a clinician who was interviewing people who had special experiences that were hard to explain. But as he got into it, he became, as he understood it, part of something larger. And that became a larger visionary and spiritual idea and quest, much more than a mere scientific study.
John Mack's interest in people's belief systems had taken him and his family all over the world.
I love this photo here. Yeah,
in later life, he would meet Yasser Arafat and the Dalai Lama. And in his early 30s, he went to live and work in Japan.
In a little kimono.
That's right, that's Danny.
Sally Mack was married to John for 36 years. She's a social worker specializing in family crises and has also worked on child abuse programs and with adult post-trauma reactions. Her understanding of her husband's decision to work on alien abduction experiences was both personal and professional.
John always asked questions that nobody else asked. it irritated him that people were passive about, oh, this is what we're supposed to believe. Oh, good. We all believe it, you know. He didn't accept that.
His work on these experiences, did he see that as simply yet another professional challenge?
Originally, he was just curious about it. The first person who told him about it, he said, oh, my goodness, they've got to be crazy. And the people who believe them and are interviewing them have really got to be crazy. This friend said, well, just give it a chance. Just talk to them. And I remember he came home and said, you know what? They're not crazy. I know mental illness. These people are not mentally ill. Something has happened. They've been traumatized in some way. And so he began to see that perhaps there were phenomena that occurred that we have no way of explaining.
How did you feel when he told you that he was going to be working with these people?
I didn't judge it. I mean, I had trouble accepting it because it was terrifying. He did it in our house. He didn't do it at the hospital. So people would come to the house, and he would do hypnotic regressions with them upstairs in Danny's bedroom. I think, this is my child's bedroom. These people are having these, you know, I could hear some of them screaming sometimes. Now, I'm a therapist. I've had people cry and scream and hide behind the sofa and climb into closets. But I didn't understand what these people were going through. I couldn't see them. I could only hear their voices. I mean, I'd see them when they'd come in, and they looked like very healthy, normal, pleasant people.
You must have worried, though, that it was perhaps making him look academically foolish.
I did, but I also admired him tremendously. He wasn't frivolous about it. He really studied it. He really thought about it. I thought he had guts. I just thought, that's amazing that he's willing to do this. Part of it was his own determination not to be pushed around and intimidated. And part of it was his incredible compassion for the people who were, quote, different.
I'm getting all these flashbacks of all these different things, God.
Whatever needs to come will come. Just let it come, whatever it is.
10 years ago, hypnotic regression was an accepted psychiatric tool, and it was often used by John Mack and others to help unlock a patient's forgotten or suppressed memories.
Where are you right now?
Oh, my shit.
Peter Faust underwent this technique during some of his sessions with Mack.
Hey, look in my eyes. They tell me not to be afraid, don't be afraid.
Today, hypnotic regression is considered an unreliable memory retrieval technique. Harvard psychologist Dr. Richard McNally.
Hypnosis does have its uses. So, for example, it can be often effective in reducing pain. The problem with hypnosis is what it does is people will generate material that they often mistake for being genuine memories, but the accuracy of the material generated is likely to be incorrect is correct. And so this is not a technique that people should be using. Granted, throughout the 1990s, it was used a lot and occasionally still is by people who are unfamiliar with the pitfalls of hypnosis as a memory retrieval technique.
There's a very large number of people who have had these experiences who do not have to access them with hypnosis. The only thing a regression or a relaxation allows us to do is to find missing pieces. Like, we'll have like spot memories, like we'll remember the beginning of it and bits and pieces of the middle that we can take out, and then remember the end being popped back in or something. And if so, if we're trying to figure out, all right, where's the rest of it, the regression can be useful in that way.
During formal sessions with an experiencer, John Mack always had a colleague with him. One such colleague was Dr. Jeff Rudiger, who, apart from being a fellow psychiatrist, is also the medical director at the McLean Psychiatric Hospital in Belmont, Massachusetts.
John never saw abductees alone, and so we saw many individuals together over a period of probably 4 years.
There has been some question about the reliability of hypnosis during these procedures. Is that valid criticism?
It's very valid. Hypnosis is controversial, and understandably so. John did not understand what he was doing as really being hypnosis. He believed that what he was doing was relaxing people so that they could talk about what they'd experienced without their defenses coming to the fore so quickly.
Jeff Rudiger is also a theologian, so I asked him if the reports from alien abductees could be compared to a religious experience
or vision?
I think that's an excellent question and one that's not easy to answer. When people would talk about the experiences they were having, sometimes they would talk about these experiences as being tangibly real phenomena with material beings that they believed they were interacting with. Other times they use language more appropriate to dream states and visions that they had. Sometimes people were asleep when they had these experiences. Sometimes they were awake and it was broad daylight. John struggled for many years with whether these experiences are best understood as metaphorical or objectively real. The worldview subscribed to by the Western religions, in my opinion, also has had some difficulties around how to interpret spiritual experience. The direction in which John began to move, especially in later years, I believe, was to look at some of the structures of consciousness appropriated by some of the Eastern cultures. John was fascinated by those ways of understanding the world and spent many years, especially the last decades of his life, trying to understand those.
This doesn't belong in any discipline, because it doesn't belong in mental health. It doesn't belong in physics. It doesn't belong in religion. It doesn't belong in anthropology. It doesn't belong in history of science. And yet, each of those disciplines has something to contribute. The point is that if something doesn't fit our notions of reality, and yet the people that are having an experience that doesn't fit are of sound mind, or sincere, or nothing to gain, or in effect opening to other realities, then it seems to me the responsibility of academicians as well as theologians is to begin to question our notions of reality.
Psychologist Richard McNally took another viewpoint. He thought there was a simpler, more rational explanation. So he conducted research into false memory syndrome and post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD, on Vietnam veterans. He discovered what he believed was the answer John Mack had been looking for.
We've arrived, I think, at a recipe for an alien abductee. First of all, I agree with Mack that these people are not lying. We did psychiatric assessments on them, and they are not mentally ill. So what's going on? What we found, the sort of typical profile, is someone who has the following characteristics. First, they endorse a wide range of New Age beliefs. So alien encounters is just one among many beliefs that they endorse. Second, they're characterized by absorption, a personality trait that is linked to fantasy proneness. They have a rich imagination. A third factor is that they are familiar with the alien abduction narrative. Then, I think a key factor is that they have episodes of sleep paralysis accompanied by hypnopompic, upon awakening, hallucinations. And this is a key factor. During one of these episodes, what happens is as follows. The person is awakening from rapid eye movement sleep, REM sleep, the stage of sleep when we do most of our dreaming. But in one of these episodes, the person begins to awaken, their eyes open, and they are fully aware of the fact that they're paralyzed and cannot move. Most people find this quite terrifying. Now, during one of these episodes, the person will often experience the intrusion of REM mentation into wakefulness. They are dreaming with their eyes open. So they will sense a presence in the room. They'll often hear footsteps. They'll feel tingling sensations through their body, a feeling of levitation. They might hear buzzing sounds or lights flashing. Moments later, they'll become fully awake. They can move again. The hallucinations vanish. And they wonder, what was that? This is quite a traumatic event for them initially. In fact, when we've studied these people in the laboratory, when they hear audio tape scripts of their quote-unquote abduction memories, they show heightened physiologic reactivity. Their heart starts pounding. They start sweating. Their facial grimacing occurs, all measured by monitors revealed on our computers to be just as reactive as someone with, say, combat trauma from the Vietnam War.
If it's known within medical circles, psychiatrists, psychologists, I assume, why didn't John Mack take that into consideration?
I've raised this topic with him as well. I says, John, this is sleep paralysis. These are hypnopompic hallucinations, etc. And his reply would be, well, but some of our alien encounters occur outside of sleep.
So where does this leave John Mack's research. Where does it go from here? Is it more than sleep paralysis? Is there something happening within the brain?
Interestingly, when they hear an alternative explanation, they are resistant to accepting that. They don't buy it. And so there's a spiritual payoff, ultimately, from these folks that makes them resistant to accepting an alternative, rather mundane, explanation for their experience. And that's the same with John Mack. He was a very spiritual type of guy. I mean, when I asked him once, do you really believe that people can be whisked through walls? And he says to me, well, you know, Rich, you are trapped within a Western scientific framework. If you look at it from an Eastern perspective, there's multiple levels of consciousness, blah, blah, blah. He turned on the fog machine. I had no idea what he was talking about at this point. But he was very resistant to those type of explanations. In fact, when he saw our psychophysiologic data, of course, he was quite excited by this. But he says, aha, here's evidence that something must have happened. Surely the mind, imagination, cannot produce physiological reactions that are greater than that of the Vietnam vets with PTSD. Surely something must have happened. He underestimates the power of imagination, in my opinion.
Rich McNally is only one of many people who are insisting that this is either sleep paralysis or some imagined state. Never mind the dysfunctions completely differently than sleep paralysis, and that sleep paralysis doesn't have all of the same narratives. And sleep paralysis doesn't generate an evolution of consciousness or shift in consciousness that these experiences are generating.
But you've got to understand Richard McNally's point of view, because it is the logical one within the framework of which most people live.
I see that what Rich McNally is doing is natural. That's his need to make sense about what's happening here. These experiences fall outside of our definition of reality. And what happens to the receiver or the listener when they hear that?
You must have taken some solace, though, that at least there was a scientific experiment that showed that there was a very strong physiological response, i.e. you were not imagining something.
Absolutely. It was satisfying to know that here was something measurable. So to get that it was a powerful enough experience that our body would create very, very strong reactions in hearing it was definitely satisfying. So that's the small piece of comfort to take out of it. But the rather large piece of discomfort, you know, that we all sit with is that, you know, these experiences aren't happening anymore. This phenomena has interjected itself into our lives. It's left. If it was sleep paralysis, then I would still be reporting the same things over and over again. And I'm not reporting that, and neither are other experiencers. Most of us would like to know what the hell happened.
John Mack's book, based on his research with more than 100 experiences, was called Abduction, Human Encounters with Aliens. Published in 1994, it was an instant bestseller and made Mack internationally famous and infamous.
Welcome to another presentation of the Emerging Renaissance and Odyssey of the Spirit with Dr. John Mack from Harvard University, the Department of Science.
I was quite high profile in the spring of 1994 when my book first came out, and that was part of the enthusiasm of my publishers. And I began to feel uneasy that maybe I'd better see how this was going down in the dean's office.
Mack went to see the then dean at Harvard Medical School, and was informed that a committee had been appointed to investigate his research on alien abductees.
And I knew him well. He was a friend. He said, John, you know, if you just said this was a new psychiatric syndrome, you wouldn't have gotten into trouble. He says, it's because you said it required that we change our view of reality that a problem has arisen here. The point had to do with the fact that they didn't like what I was saying. And what particularly they tried to silenced me around was the notion that by supporting the truth of what these people were experiencing, possibly I was affirming them in a distortion or in a delusion. That's what I had to fight, that I was actually harming my own clients by believing them or by taking them seriously.
John knew instantly that this was going to be a very contested proceeding, and that he could, in fact, be the first faculty member in the history of this university to lose his tenure.
Attorney Eric McLeish was appointed by John to defend him. He saw the internal investigation as a case for academic freedom, and also one where Harvard Medical School was distorting John Mack's views by saying he believed in aliens.
It was really outrageous that this man had to go through this inquiry. The idea that John Mack would put his own agenda above the interests of his patients was abhorrent. There was never any proof of it. And the evidence that we mustered was exactly the opposite, that he was simply willing to listen. So our defense was, you're distorting John's views. Who better to talk about the harm that he was doing to his patients than his patients? And so I talked to more than 70 people that John had treated. Most people were more than happy, some anonymously, some with their names. I spoke with a judge in California. The only person that this man had ever told was John Mack. He was too petrified to tell anybody else. John Mack was his lifeline. You know, what this really was about was Harvard saying, look, you know, we don't like this because you can't show any of this through double-blind, placebo-controlled study. And John was really saying, well, you know, there's some real mysteries here. And I don't know what's going on with these people, but I can't dismiss them as mentally ill.
When did they suddenly realize we're not going to win here? Mm-hmm. Mac does have a right to academic freedom.
Well, it wasn't for a long time. Once we started talking to the media, I had a sense that this was going to resolve. If we were going to have a full-blown trial, we were going to bring in people, and we were going to want the proceeding to be a public one. And we made that clear. I think the judge in California was prepared to fly in. People were willing to sacrifice their anonymity. And I don't think that's what Harvard had in mind at all.
After 14 months of stressful and bitter negotiations, the investigation was over. Free to pursue his research, John Mack started the John Mack Institute. The aim was to explore how different perceptions and beliefs about reality shape the human condition. But after Mack's untimely death in England, he was killed in a car accident while attending a conference on T.E. Lawrence, what will be his legacy? Will he be remembered for his work as a psychologist, as Sally Mack and many of his professional colleagues believe, or, as Dr. J. Lifton wonders, and many of Mack's obituaries suggest, will he always be known as the Harvard professor who believed in aliens?
I don't think there's anything wrong with his being remembered for what he did in relationship to research on aliens, as long as it's thought about seriously in terms of his efforts and what he was after.
He was just an extraordinary therapist and teacher, so I don't think that will ever be forgotten. I would hope that if more is understood and accepted, that John will get some credit for paving the way. What I think he really did, and maybe this will really make a difference for people, is that he listened to people that other people wouldn't listen to.
Abduction, Alienation and Reason was presented by Sue Nelson. It was a peer production for BBC Radio 4 by Angela Hind.